Income inequality, you know, it feels like it's always right there on the global agenda, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And policymakers around the world have, well, they've tried a lot of different things to try to shrink that gap between the rich and the poor.
You've got the classics, right? Progressive taxes, where the more you earn, the bigger the chunk you pay back.
Right.
Then there are government subsidies, trying to make certain goods and services more affordable for everyone.
Like food or fuel, for example.
Exactly. And then, of course, huge public spending projects, you know, big infrastructure, things like that. But lately, there's been a bit of a buzz around a different approach, voucher programs.
Yeah, voucher systems. It's interesting, isn't it? Because they're kind of a more targeted way of getting help to people who need it.
And that's exactly what we're going to be digging into in this deep dive today.
Yeah, the big question we're tackling is how do these voucher systems actually stack up against those more traditional methods when we're trying to reduce income inequality?
It's a fascinating question, and we've got a really cool research paper to help us explore it.
We do. It takes a counterfactual approach.
So, for our listener, think of that as a what-if kind of analysis.
Exactly. It's like saying, what if this policy had been in place? What would have happened to income inequality?
And the study looks at data from 12 countries over 22 years, so quite a large scale.
It is. It's global in scope, which is really valuable. And their main measure of inequality is the Gini coefficient.
Yeah, which is pretty much the go-to metric when you're looking at these kinds of economic disparities. So our mission today is to figure out if vouchers could actually be a more effective weapon or maybe a really powerful partner in this whole fight against income inequality.
I like that. A powerful partner.
Right. Because it's not always about replacing everything, but maybe finding what works best in different situations.
Yeah, exactly.
So before we dive into the nitty-gritty, we should probably tell you where we're getting all this juicy info from.
Definitely.
Our discussion today is based on a research paper titled Contrafactual Analysis, comparing voucher systems with taxes, subsidies, and public spending to reduce income inequality. It's by W. Alejandro Pacheco Jaramillo. He's from the University Anahuac in Mexico.
Yeah.
And Peter Maliaras, he's from Our Community in Australia.
Very cool.
So a nice global perspective there.
It is, yeah.
Okay, so the paper sets the stage for us, but we really want to dig in and understand what it means for you, the listener. So let's start with the basics. What exactly are we talking about when we say voucher systems?
Okay, well, imagine a voucher as kind of like a government coupon.
A coupon, I like that.
But it's not for just anything, it's for essential services, things like education, maybe healthcare. Couldn't it be housing?
So it's kind of like a subsidy, but instead of just getting cash, you get this voucher that you can only use at certain places.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Think of it like this. With a direct cash transfer, you can use that money for, well, anything really.
Rent, groceries, you name it.
Exactly. And with broad public spending, well, the benefits might not reach those most in need right away. You know, it takes time.
So vouchers are about targeting, getting those resources directly to those services that are, well, essential.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's vouchers in a nutshell. But how do they compare to the other big players in this game of income redistribution? You've got progressive taxation, general subsidies, and public spending. How do those work?
Right. So progressive taxation, that's the idea that as your income goes up, the percentage of tax you pay also goes up. The higher earners contribute more.
Right, it's like a sliding scale. The more you make, the more you give back.
Exactly. And the idea is that this generates government revenue that can then be used for social programs and initiatives that tend to benefit lower income groups more.
Okay, so more taxes from the wealthy, more resources for those who need them. Makes sense. What about public spending?
Public spending is when the government invests in things that benefit everyone, like roads or the public education system or hospitals.
So things we all use and benefit from. And subsidies. Remind us again how those work.
Subsidies are usually some kind of financial support that's aimed at making specific goods or services more affordable.
Okay, give us some examples.
Sure. It could be subsidies for fuel, for example, to help lower the cost of transportation, or subsidies for food to make sure everyone has access to basic necessities.
Right, so the government steps in to help lower those costs. And these subsidies can be broad, affecting everyone, or they can be more targeted to help specific groups.
Exactly.
Now, you both mentioned the Gini coefficient a couple of times. For our listener who might not be an economics buff, can you break down what exactly that is and what it tells us about income inequality?
Sure. The Gini coefficient, it's a number, a single number that tells us how income is distributed across everyone in a country or a region.
Okay, so it's a snapshot of how evenly or unevenly spread the wealth is.
Exactly. And it runs on a scale from 0 to 1.
Zero being the best case scenario,
Yeah,
right?
exactly.
Yeah.
A Gini coefficient of 0 would mean perfect equality. Everyone earns the same amount.
Total utopia, everyone's equal.
Yeah, pretty much. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got a Gini coefficient of 1, which means that means one person has all the income and everyone else has nothing. Total inequality.
Oh, so the closer you get to zero, the more equal things are.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when we talk about policies to reduce income inequality, what we're really trying to do is push that Gini coefficient closer to 0.
Got it. Lower Gini, more equality, happier society.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Okay, now this paper uses something called contrafactual analysis, which sounds a bit like, I don't know, a time travel experiment. Can you explain what that actually means in plain English?
Right. Contrafactual analysis, it's a fancy way of saying what if. It's basically about creating and then analyzing these hypothetical scenarios. So in this study, the researchers looked at what actually happened with income inequality in these 12 countries over the 22 years. That's the real-world data. But then they used statistical methods to create these hypothetical scenarios. For instance, they might say, what if this country had implemented a large-scale voucher program during this time? Or what if they had decided to invest way more in public education?
Right, so it's like rewinding history and saying, okay, let's tweak this one thing and see how things would play out differently.
Exactly. And by comparing these imagined outcomes to what really happened, they can try to estimate what impact those different policy choices might have had on income inequality.
Okay, that's actually really cool. So they're essentially running these simulations to see which policy levers have the biggest effect on reducing that income gap.
Precisely. It's like a policy laboratory.
I love it.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's get to the heart of it. What did the study actually find when it compared these different approaches? Let's start with voucher systems themselves.
Okay, well, the study indicates that well-designed voucher systems, they can be a really good way to make sure people get access to those key services. Education, healthcare. Remember we said vouchers were targeted? Well, that means they can directly improve access for lower-income groups because the funds are just for those specific needs.
It's like a direct pipeline, getting that support right where it's needed most.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the researchers really emphasize the potential for that kind of precision. It's about making sure the resources actually get to the people who need them, not just getting lost in the system somewhere.
Okay, so vouchers get points for being super focused, but what about the more traditional approach of just increasing public spending on things like schools and hospitals? How did that stack up?
This is where it gets really interesting. The study really strongly suggests that public spending on education and healthcare, it's incredibly powerful when it comes to narrowing income disparities.
Why is that?
Well, think about it. These sectors, they're fundamental. They address some of those root causes of inequality in society.
Right, because if everyone has access to good education and healthcare, that levels the playing field in a major way, right?
Exactly. Investing in education can lead to better jobs, better earning potential, especially for those who might have started out at a disadvantage. And having access to good healthcare prevents those health issues from pushing families into poverty.
It's like breaking that cycle of poverty.
Exactly. And the study actually backs this up with references to earlier research. For example, Gupta et al. Back in 2002, they showed how healthcare spending in developing countries had a big impact on reducing income gaps. They also talk about Blandin in 2005 and the OECD in 2021. Their research also emphasizes how investing in education can boost social mobility and bring down those Gini coefficients. And there's also a really cool example from Barber and Gertler.
Okay, tell us about that.
So they observed in Mexico how targeting funding for rural clinics, specifically rural clinics, actually led to improved health outcomes. It highlights how important it is to make sure that public spending gets to the right places, you know, where it's most needed.
So it's not just about throwing money at the problem. It's about smart strategic investment.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got vouchers, which are precise, and public spending, which has this broad systemic impact. What about progressive taxation? That's often touted as a key way to redistribute wealth. How did that perform in the study?
It's interesting. The study found that progressive taxation has a bit of a mixed record. While in general, countries with higher tax revenues do tend to have lower income inequality, it's not always a straightforward relationship.
Meaning.
Well, a lot depends on the specific circumstances of that country, things like how efficient their tax system is. Can they actually collect the money they're supposed to collect?
Right. It's one thing to have high tax rates on paper, but another to actually get people to pay them.
Exactly. And then there's the whole question of what happens with those tax revenues. How does the government use them? Does it actually go towards programs that benefit lower income groups?
So the political environment matters a lot, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So just having higher tax rates for the wealthy, it doesn't automatically solve the problem. It really depends on how well that whole system functions.
Got it. So it's not a magic bullet, but it can be an important part of the solution if it's done right. And what about subsidies? How did they fare?
The study indicates that subsidies, on their own, they tend to only lead to modest reductions in income gaps. And sometimes the results are even inconsistent.
Inconsistent.
Yeah, meaning that sometimes they seem to have an impact and sometimes not really. And the researchers point out that while subsidies might provide some immediate relief for people, they don't always address those root causes of inequality we talked about.
So it's like a Band-Aid solution, but not a cure.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. They give a few examples, like Clements et al. In 2013, they looked at energy subsidies and found that they can sometimes actually benefit wealthier households more.
Why is that?
Because wealthier households often consume more energy. So if you subsidize energy, they end up getting a bigger piece of the pie.
Right. That makes sense.
Then there's Alderman and Yemsov's work in 2014 on targeted food subsidies. And Revalian in 2016 looked at rural subsidies. What they found was that when those subsidies are really focused, aimed at very specific groups that are in need, then they can be more effective.
Okay, so again, it's about targeting. We're seeing a theme here.
We are. And actually, there's some really interesting research on how technology can help make subsidies even more precise. Aker et al. In 2017, they looked at digital payment systems in Africa and how they can help make sure that the right people are getting those subsidies.
It's like using technology to fine-tune those support systems.
Exactly.
So with vouchers, subsidies, and public spending, it seems like the more targeted they are, the bigger the impact they have.
Exactly.
Now, what about combining these different approaches? The study talked about a synergistic approach, which sounds very fancy. What does that mean for our listener?
It basically means that the most effective way to tackle income inequality might not be to rely on just one tool.
Right. It's not about choosing one over the other, but about finding the right mix.
Exactly. The study argues that voucher programs can be really powerful when they're part of a bigger strategy.
Okay, what does that strategy look like?
It includes things like progressive taxation to generate the funds needed for those programs and strategic public spending, especially in areas like education and healthcare.
So it's like creating this web of support where each element reinforces the others.
Exactly. And they cite some research that supports this.
Massively.
At all.
Yeah.
In 2016, they did a meta-analysis that showed that combining policies is often more effective than using them in isolation.
And what about real-world examples? Are there any countries that are already doing this kind of combined approach?
Yeah, there are. They give the example of Brazil's Bolsa Família program, which is really well-known.
Remind us how that works.
It combines things like direct cash transfers, food assistance, and healthcare incentives. And it's had a really significant positive impact on both income distribution and overall well-being in Brazil, as highlighted by Soares et al. In 2010.
So it's not just about lifting people out of poverty, but also about improving their health and their overall quality of life.
Exactly.
Now, the study doesn't just focus on the mechanics of these policies. It also reminds us why addressing income inequality is so important in the first place, right?
Absolutely. It's not just an economic theory. It has real consequences for people's lives.
So what are some of the negative impacts of high levels of income inequality?
Well, it can lead to increased social unrest, you know, when people feel like the system is rigged against them. It can actually hold back economic growth because if a huge chunk of the population doesn't have the resources to participate in the economy, everyone suffers.
It's like a drag on the whole system.
Exactly. And it can even make political divisions worse, leading to more polarization and extremism. The study cites a bunch of research on this. You've got Alvarado et al. In 2018, Atkinson in 2015, Bartels in 2016, Stiglitz in 2018, and the OECD in 2021. They all talk about these serious negative consequences of unchecked income inequality.
So it's not just about fairness, it's about creating a more stable, prosperous, and cohesive society.
Exactly.
Now, there's another idea that's been getting a lot of attention lately as a potential solution to inequality, and that's universal basic income, or UBI. The paper touches on this briefly. How does that fit into the conversation?
Yeah, UBI. That's another fascinating approach, although the study doesn't dive deep into it. Mainly because there isn't a lot of real-world data on large-scale, long-term implementations of UBI yet.
So it's more of a theoretical concept at this point.
In many ways, yes. But it's still worth considering as we think about different ways to address income inequality.
Okay, so remind our listener what UBI actually is.
In a nutshell, UBI is a system where every single person in a country, regardless of their income or whether they have a job, receives a regular cash payment from the government.
So no strings attached, just a guaranteed income floor for everyone.
Exactly. And this is very different from vouchers, which are targeted at specific services.
Okay.
With UBI, there's no restriction on how you can use the money.
So it's about giving people financial security and freedom of choice. What are some of the potential benefits of this kind of system?
There are a few key arguments in favor of UBI. First, it could potentially cut down on a lot of the bureaucracy that you get with traditional welfare programs because there wouldn't be all these complex eligibility requirements. It would just be a universal benefit for everyone.
Okay, so less red tape, more streamlined.
Exactly. It also offers a guaranteed safety net, which could significantly reduce poverty rates. And this financial security could actually give people more flexibility in their lives to pursue education, start businesses, or just have a bit more breathing room.
Right. It could empower people to make different choices.
Exactly. Some research even suggests that it could lead to lower administrative costs overall, which is interesting. Standing's work from 2017 talks about that. And Weiderquist and Sheehan, in 2012, they even argued that UBI could actually boost entrepreneurship because it gives people that financial cushion to take risks.
So it's like a safety net that also enables people to be more innovative and entrepreneurial. Sounds pretty good. But I know there are also some big concerns about UBI.
Oh, absolutely. And the biggest one is cost. Providing a basic income to everyone in a country, especially in a large country, is incredibly expensive.
Right. It's a huge undertaking.
It is. And because it's universal, it means you're giving money to people who might not necessarily need it, which raises questions about efficiency, especially compared to targeted programs like vouchers.
So some people might argue that it's better to focus those resources on those who are truly struggling.
Exactly. There are also concerns about potential inflation. If you suddenly give everyone more money to spend, demand might go up. But if supply doesn't keep pace, prices could rise. Van Praes and Vanderbilt talked about this in their 2017 book.
So it's about finding that balance between stimulating the economy and making sure prices don't spiral out of control.
Exactly. And then there's the big question mark around work incentives. Would people still be motivated to work if they know they're getting a basic income?
Right. Will people become complacent or drop out of the workforce?
That's a big worry for a lot of people. Moffitt raised this concern in 2015. So while UBI has a lot of interesting potential benefits, there are definitely some big challenges that need to be carefully considered before it could be implemented on a large scale.
Okay, so it's a promising idea, but it needs a lot more testing and fine-tuning before it can become a reality. And from a practical standpoint, how does the political feasibility of implementing UBI compare to something like voucher programs?
Well, the paper highlights an interesting observation. Voucher programs tend to be a lot more politically palatable than UBI.
Why is that?
Well, UBI often faces strong opposition from both sides of the political spectrum. You have concerns about the cost, concerns about potential inflation, and worries about those work disincentives we talked about. It can be a tough sell.
Yeah.
But voucher programs, they've actually been more successful in getting bipartisan support in various countries. You see them in the U.S., in Brazil, in India. And that's likely because they're often seen as more targeted interventions. They're supporting specific sectors. They usually align more with existing social safety net structures. And they don't require this huge overhaul of the entire public finance system.
So they're seen as less radical, less disruptive.
Exactly. They also tend to preserve more market-based price signals, which appeals to some policymakers who are wary of too much government intervention. So from a practical standpoint, in many contexts, vouchers might be an easier policy to actually implement right now.
Okay, that makes sense. So while UBI is out there as an idea, the study we're focusing on really zooms in on those specifics of voucher programs. Let's go back to that contrafactual analysis and see how the researchers actually simulated those different policy scenarios.
Right, so remember that the whole idea behind contrafactual analysis is to compare what actually happened with these what-if scenarios, these hypothetical situations. They start with a baseline, which is essentially representing those existing policies in those 12 countries over that 22-year period.
Okay.
Then they create those contrafactual scenarios where they imagine specific policy changes, like what if the government spent more on voucher programs? Or what if they moved money from existing programs to fund these voucher programs?
So they're playing around with different policy levers to see how it might have changed the outcome.
Exactly. And they focused their voucher program simulations on three key countries: the U.S. as a developed economy, India as a large emerging market, and then Mexico as another important emerging market. And they looked at different levels of voucher spending.
Okay, give us some numbers.
So they considered spending levels ranging from 0.2% of GDP all the way up to 1% of GDP. But in their main simulations, they used an average of 0.5% of GDP.
Okay, so half a percentage point of the entire economy going towards voucher programs, that's significant.
It is. And they based this range on existing research on social spending. Moffitt's work from 2015 was a key reference point.
Okay, so they're grounding their simulations in real-world data and existing research.
Exactly. And here's how they actually incorporated voucher spending into their statistical model. They added a specific measure for it. So now their model could estimate how changes in voucher spending might influence income inequality as measured by that Gini coefficient we talked about.
Okay, that makes sense. But they did something else interesting too, right, with tax revenue.
They did. They added what's called an interaction term between voucher spending and tax revenue. This is a bit technical, but basically what it allows them to do is to see if the impact of those voucher programs on inequality is different, maybe stronger, in countries that also have higher levels of tax revenue.
So it's like saying, okay, if you have more tax revenue, does that make voucher programs even more effective at reducing inequality?
Exactly. It's testing whether that funding mechanism for the vouchers, which is implicitly coming from the tax system, actually plays a role in their impact.
Okay, I'm following. So they've got this more nuanced model that takes into account both the level of voucher spending and how that interacts with the existing tax system. And then they ran their simulations under three main scenarios, right?
Right. The first one was the baseline, which is just using those existing levels of voucher spending, which in many cases were very minimal or non-existent because formal voucher programs weren't in place. Then they had a moderate expansion scenario where they said, okay, what if we allocate 0.5% of GDP to vouchers? And then a more significant expansion scenario where they booked that up to 1% of GDP. And for that last one, they assumed it would be funded through a mix of existing tax revenue and maybe reallocating some spending from existing subsidies.
So they're really trying to get a comprehensive picture of how vouchers might work in different budget scenarios. And what were they expecting to find when they ran these simulations?
Their main hypothesis was that they'd see a reduction in income inequality as that level of simulated voucher spending went up. They also thought that voucher programs that are effectively funded through tax revenue might be even more effective at reducing inequality compared to just relying on general taxation or shifting money from other areas.
Okay, so they set up these scenarios to really put vouchers to the test. Now, let's get to the results. They looked at advanced economies, emerging markets, and developing economies separately. What did they find in each of those categories? Let's start with the advanced economies. The US, Germany, Japan, Australia. What did the data tell us about them?
Right. So for those advanced economies, their model showed a really strong link between public investment in both education and healthcare and lower levels of inequality. Yeah. The more they spent on those things, the lower the Gini coefficient tended to be.
Okay. So again, we're seeing that those investments in people really matter.
They do. And they found that higher tax revenues were also linked to significantly lower levels of inequality. So countries that were able to collect more taxes tended to have a more equal distribution of income.
So having a strong tax base seems to be important for reducing inequality in these wealthier nations.
It does. And interestingly, general subsidies and overall GDP growth didn't have a statistically significant impact on inequality in these advanced economies.
Sure.
But the poverty rate did.
Meaning?
It means that even in these relatively well-off countries, if you have higher rates of poverty, you tend to see greater income inequality.
So poverty is a key driver of inequality, even in developed countries.
It is. And the study provides all the nitty-gritty statistical details in their tables. If you're interested in the exact coefficients and significance levels, you can check those out. But the main takeaway is that education, healthcare, and effective tax collection are key for keeping inequality in check in those advanced economies.
Okay, so invest in people, collect taxes effectively, and try to reduce poverty. That's the recipe for advanced economies. What about the emerging markets like India, Mexico, China, and South Africa? How did they fare?
In emerging markets, some of the findings were similar, but there were some interesting nuances as well. They found that government spending on education and healthcare was really important in those countries too. Higher spending led to lower Gini coefficients. And tax revenue was also a big factor. More tax revenue meant less inequality. But just like in those advanced economies, they found a strong link between poverty and inequality. The higher the poverty rate, the higher the Gini coefficients tended to be. And while GDP growth seemed like it might be helpful in reducing inequality, it wasn't statistically significant in their analysis.
Okay, so those investments in human capital and a solid tax base seem to be important across different levels of economic development. What about the developing economies? Ecuador, Peru, Colombia, and the Philippines. What did the study tell us about them?
For the developing economies, the results were a bit different. Tax revenue was still a major player. Higher tax revenue meant lower inequality. But GDP growth actually seemed to have a slightly more noticeable impact in those countries, though it was still kind of borderline statistically significant. And poverty, again, was a huge factor. Higher poverty meant higher inequality. But in this group, the effects of subsidies, education spending, and healthcare spending weren't statistically significant in their model, even though the estimated effects were negative.
So it seems like those investments in education and healthcare might have a less clear-cut impact on inequality in those developing economies.
Yeah, and the researchers think that this could be because of things like smaller sample sizes and just more variability in how those public services are delivered and accessed in those countries. So more research is definitely needed there. But the key takeaway for developing economies seems to be that getting that tax system right, getting those revenues in, is really crucial for tackling inequality. And of course, addressing poverty is absolutely paramount.
Right. If you have huge portions of the population living in poverty, it's going to be very difficult to create a more equal society. Okay, so we've looked at the results for each group of economies. What about the global picture? Did they find any overall trends when they looked at all 12 countries together?
They did. When they combined all the data, they found that education spending, healthcare spending, and tax revenue were all statistically significant in reducing inequality. More spending, more taxes, lower Gini coefficient, and the poverty rate was also a big factor globally. Higher poverty, higher inequality. Mm. But in that global model, the effects of subsidies and GDP growth were not statistically significant.
Okay, so it really highlights the importance of those core public investments and effective tax systems.
Exactly.
Now, let's get back to the heart of our discussion today, which is that counterfactual analysis focusing on voucher programs. What happened when they ran those simulations with different levels of voucher spending? What did that tell us about how vouchers might work in the real world?
Right. So remember, they used that modified model that included not just the level of voucher spending, but also that interaction term with tax revenue, showing how those two things might work together. And they came up with a specific formula to estimate how changes in voucher spending might affect the Gini coefficient.
Okay, I remember that formula. It looked a bit intimidating, but it basically helps us understand how much the Gini coefficient is expected to change when you increase voucher spending and how taxes play into that.
Exactly. And based on their analysis, they estimated that a moderate expansion of voucher programs, where they allocated 0.5% of GDP to vouchers, could lead to a reduction of about 1.2 points on the Gini index.
Okay, so a noticeable drop in inequality.
Right. And when they simulated a larger expansion, allocating a full 1% of GDP to vouchers, and assuming some of that was funded through taxes, the estimated reduction in the Gini index was even bigger, about 2.5 points.
That's pretty substantial.
It is, and it really highlights that idea of synergy that we talked about earlier. When those voucher programs are paired with a solid tax system that can help fund them, they can have a much bigger impact on reducing inequality.
So it's not just about the vouchers themselves, but about how they fit into the bigger picture of a country's budget and policies.
Exactly.
Okay, so they've crunched the numbers, they've run the simulations. Based on all of this, what are the main policy implications of this study? What are the takeaways for policymakers in those different types of economies?
Well, for those advanced economies, where they're already seeing good results from spending on education and healthcare, the study suggests that adding well-designed, tax-funded voucher programs could be a way to further refine their approach. It's like taking those existing efforts and making them even more targeted and effective.
So it's about building on that strong foundation they already have. What about emerging markets?
For emerging markets, where poverty is still such a huge factor, they suggest that vouchers could be a really useful addition to the existing tools. They can help get those essential resources directly to people who are struggling, alongside those broader public spending initiatives.
So it's about adding another layer of support to those who need it most. And what about developing economies? What's the advice for them?
For developing economies, the study suggests that vouchers could be a really valuable new approach, especially if they're designed carefully, with a focus on targeting and integrated with those broader strategies to alleviate poverty. Because remember, in those countries, getting those tax revenues flowing and boosting overall economic growth seem to be especially crucial for reducing inequality.
So vouchers could be part of a multi-pronged approach.
Exactly.
Okay, so the overall message is that vouchers aren't necessarily meant to replace those existing tools, but they can be a powerful addition to the toolkit.
Exactly.
But the paper also points out some limitations to their analysis. What are some of the things we should keep in mind when we're interpreting these findings?
Right. It's important to remember that this is a complex issue, and like any study, there are some limitations. The researchers acknowledge that the quality of the data can vary, especially in those developing countries. So the results might not be perfectly precise in every case.
Okay, so take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, a little bit. And they primarily focused on those direct effects of the policies. They didn't go deep into those long-term indirect impacts, like how these policies might affect social mobility or overall economic growth down the line.
Right, so more research is needed to get that full picture.
Exactly. And they also mentioned that because they didn't have consistent data on formal voucher programs for every country in their study, they had to rely on some estimates and simulations for certain parts of their analysis. So it's good to be aware of that.
Okay, so we're seeing some really encouraging results, but it's important to remember that there are some gaps in the data and more research is always needed. Now, the paper ends on a really intriguing note, especially in their recommendations section. They point to a potential new way to think about funding these kinds of social programs. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is a really interesting idea. They suggest looking beyond just tax revenue for funding these kinds of initiatives. Specifically, they propose exploring the idea of using corporate markups as a